From the macabre minds of Laughing Devil Production comes another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind, amp up your imagination, and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted. The Return of the Moresbys by Henry Sleezar. One drop of blue dye in a gallon of water would have made the precise color of Moresby's eyes. Framed by the white bandages, their hue was only slightly more intense, and as the hospital hours passed, the blue faded in an eerie synchronization with his ebbing life. 3 hours before Moresby's end came, there was a burst of stubborn vitality in the dying man, a sudden spell of clarity, and a desire to talk. The interns would have restrained him, except for one word that Moresby used. It was the word murder. That word made Moresby's fate a police matter, and a lieutenant named Gardner was summoned to the bedside. He was the last man Moresby spoke to on earth, and he could have done worse. Lieutenant Gardner was a good listener. "I like Southern California," Moresby began. "I was born in Vermont, and never knew the time I was warm enough. I came west when I was 20, and soon discovered that sunlit indolence was the only way of life that I truly enjoyed. I lived on beaches. I became bronzed and muscular, a superb swimmer, an incorrigible loafer." It was on a beach in Southern California that I met Una, the white-skinned, bony, bountiful woman who would become my beloved, my wife, and the support of my lazy sunshine hours. Our honeymoon lasted a whole year on the beaches of the Caribbean and the French Riviera. Una got freckled. Finally, we returned to our home in Los Angeles and settled down to a quiet, companionable marriage. Una's financial resources were without end, and so was her ingenuousness. I took advantage of neither. I was not a spendthrift, nor an unfaithful husband. I was too intelligent to spoil a lifelong holiday because of petty indulgences. No, it was Una who spoiled it. Una in search of an anchor. For some people, money would have been anchor enough, but Una had been born to her wealth and felt the need of something more. For a time, marriage supplied this. Then she made a pitiful attempt at art, with a capital A. It was laughable. Then she tried a career. That too failed. Then she tried religion. It bored her. Most religion, that is. Then finally discovered the amusing variety that abounds in Southern California. She met Dr. Archibald Singh, the high priest of the temple of metempsychosis. Una was not a brilliant woman, but neither was she a complete fool. There was a case for Dr. Singh. He was an eye-stopping man, tall as a tower, and hugely shoulder, cleverly bearded for an effect of wisdom and youth combined. He avoided the usual pretensions of esoteric cults, and maintained a simple meeting place of almost monastic restraint. He wore well-tailored, everyday clothes, delivered his sermons in conversational English, and conducted his services without incense, idols, or theatrics. But he preached a doctrine intensely interesting to poor Una, a doctrine of eternal life and the love of small animals. Una first visited the temple in the company of a cocktail companion. On her second visit, she insisted I come along. I was ironically hostile to the whole thing, of course, but I still remember Dr. Singh's little speech. "The soul is immortal," he said. "The soul cannot die. The soul, upon leaving the body, must make its passage elsewhere. The science of eschatology, dealing with the last four things of death, judgment, heaven, and hell, is the most ancient of all sciences, and from its wisdom has come the inescapable certainty of the transmigration of souls." "And where does it go?" the soul, according to all the wise men of past generation, departs from the mouth of the dying, and is consequently a small thing, given to seeking a home in the body of a small thing, a bird, a snake, a mouse, a dove or a hawk, a dog, a cat, an insect. For these small creations of God are empty vessels placed on earth to house the departing souls of humanity, so they need not wander forever in a trackless eternity. Pure rot, of course, and the fact that Una didn't immediately recognize it as such was the most surprising thing I ever learned about my wife. The second surprising thing was the amount of devotion she gave to Dr. Singh and his gospel. The third surprising thing was the money. To be honest, I really didn't mind Una taking up a faith. After all, the transmigration of souls has had quite a few adherents in the history of gullible man and is no sillier concept than I've heard expressed in more westernized religions. If she wanted to end up as a homing pigeon instead of an angel, that was strictly her business, and I made no attempt to interfere. But the money, that was different. Damn it, how that money went out. Most of it, of course, went to the temple. Dr. Archibald Singh had the deepest collection plate in the spiritual kingdom, and Una seemed determined to keep it filled. Thousands more went as donations to various institutions for the care and comfort of cats, dogs, and birds. Una has always been fond of furry, romping, and flying things, but now she had an additional incentive. She was preventing cruelty to souls. Fortunately, there was no home for underprivileged insects, or she would have given money to that too. Then came the final blow. I learned that Una had decided to further Dr. Singh's good work by a gesture that would prove her absolute faith in his mission. She was altering her will to leave the bulk of her fortune to the temple. Her announcement one Friday of this intent was the cause of our first real quarrel. I told her in detail what I thought of Dr. Archibald Singh. I also made some candid remarks on her belief in transmigration. The truth is, I was very rude. She cried a great deal, and the very next morning she made a Monday appointment with her attorney. This gave me one weekend to move around in. It's amazing how fast one can think when necessity is in the driver's seat. On Saturday night, I overdosed her milk with sleeping powders, and then put on an enormous pot of coffee with which I would attempt to wake her. The coffee wasn't yet perking when the police arrived and found her dead. They were most sympathetic. At the inquest, the testimony concerning Una's preoccupation with the religion of death was considered meaningful. The verdict was suicide. But I should mention one more thing about that fateful night. Una did not die immediately. She fell into a state halfway between sleep and wakefulness, and she knew what I had done to her and why. In a terrible voice that I can summon all too easily to recollection, she swore revenge. It was mere raving, of course, but Una had a special reason for believing in vengeance from beyond the grave. "I'll come back, Richard," she said. "You'll see, I'll come back, just as Dr. Singh says." Well, I'd never liked animals much. Fangs, claws, wings, and tails had little attraction for me. As a matter of fact, I had always been slightly fearful of dogs, and the word had spread among the canine population. They say it's olfactory. Perhaps it is. At any rate, I didn't take Una's threat seriously. I was not a convert to Dr. Singh's belief in metempsychosis, and when the gentleman came to pay me a dutiful condolence call and spoke solemnly of Una's transported soul, I could not resist an open snicker. By sheer coincidence, I was chased by a mongrel on the very day of Una's interment. One of those things. I was driving home from the funeral, and this belligerent cur decided to bark at the tires of my Ferrari. I would have gladly run the creature over, but a smudgy-mouthed lad came along and cradled it in his arms. "Sorry, mister," he said. "He always barks at foreign cars." "Patriotic little beast, isn't he?" I snarled. That night, I had a terrible nightmare. 2 days later, some sort of shiny winged bird, an immense thing that might have been a pheasant, slammed against the picture window of my living room. I jumped out of my chair with a start, spilling the Balkan Sobranek out of my pipe. It was really nothing new. Birds sometimes hit that window, mistaking it for open highways. Usually they dashed their brains out and that was that. This beggar was only stunned. It lay on the patio tiles, feebly flapping its damned glossy wings. I have to admit I was terrified. I ran upstairs and called the game warden, a beefy, unimaginative man who laughed at my discomfort and ultimately removed the bird from the premises. He said something about dinner. Ugh, what if it had been Una? Cannibal. That night, there was a fly in my library. A big, buzzing, blue bottle of a fly. It was still early in spring, and that fly was surely ahead of its flight schedule. When it swooped into my vicinity, I swatted at it mightily with a copy of Fortune, and it brushed my forehead. The touch of the thing was so revolting that I actually screamed the name of my dead wife. You can see the state I was in. I finally got the thing with the bug bomb. I felt a little better the next day. I went to the beach and lay under the loving warmth of the sun and forgot about Una and her deathbed promise. I lay there and listened to the swish-swash of the tide, the comforting sound of distant laughter, the shrill cries of the gulls. The gulls. The sharp beaks, swooping creatures diving for prey, stabbing, pecking, tearing. I thought of Prometheus and his liver. The sun turned suddenly cold. I left the beach hastily and went to have dinner at a pleasant club I knew. When I left, I discovered a lunar moth as big as a child's fist on my rear window. I was driving when it flew off and fluttered around the car's interior. And that was when I had my accident. Only a minor one. I skidded over a curb, knocking down a newspaper boy. My ribs were bruised and my fender crumpled. Small damage, but enough, so I decided it was time to have a little chat with Dr. Archibald Singh. Not that I believe you understand, but he was a doctor in a way, wasn't he? When I told him of my experiences, he was greatly reassuring. "Come now," he smiled. "Do you think so little of your poor departed wife as to suspect her of such petty malice? Why should Una torment you?" "Well, we had our little disagreements," I said. "And besides, do you really think Una would be transmigrated into the forms you mentioned?" "No, no, Mr. Moresby. The process is surely not so random or so cruel." "No," I said, "certainly not. It is my sincere belief that our souls are weighed and judged by higher powers before the transformation takes place, and each of us is given the vessel which best conforms to the human personality we have left behind. Una, a car-chasing dog? Never. A bird? Perhaps. But not an ungainly pheasant. A fly? A gull? A moth? No, Mr. Moresby. You may take my word for it. That soft, gentle woman would never be so unjustly rewarded in her afterlife. These encounters of yours are pure coincidences." "Well," I sighed, "I thought as much myself. But in your opinion, if Una did come back, what sort of animal would she be?" "You know your wife best," Dr. Singh smiled. That night I heard the noise in the cellar. I was not accustomed to paying attention to house sounds. The bang of a shutter, the clank of a pipe, the knock of the furnace. These rarely bothered me. But this soft, padded sound, coming at a time of such highly nervous agitation, was irritating. I simply had to investigate its source. I tiptoed down the cellar steps and found the lighting system. One stark bulb, insufficient for a thorough search. I got a flashlight and probed the shadows. In the beginning, I had no success. Whatever had caused the noise, a mouse, was frozen into inactivity because of my investigation. I flicked off the light, held my breath, and waited. My strategy was rewarded. An empty oil can toppled over, and my flashlight beam picked out the culprit. A mouse? No. A cat. I don't like cats. Never have. They're skulking, cynical, malicious creatures. This alley denizen, its white fur shaggy, its eyes baleful in the spotlight, was monstrously big and yet strangely bony and fleshless. Like all cats, it had iridescent pupils that stared with a curious mixture of fear, hostility, and resentment. "Scat," I said. It didn't scat. It made a soft mewling sound and then came towards me. Toward me. "Una," I said. I made a cowardly dash for the cellar door. It stuck for one hideous moment and yielded to pressure. Once I had reached the other side of the door, I remembered the hunting rifle that Una had given me for Christmas. Thinking it would remind me of Vermontian pleasures, it stood unused in an upstairs closet. I found it, loaded it, and brought it back to the cellar. I hadn't fired a rifle since boyhood, but I stood on the top step of the cellar stairway, and when my flashlight beam picked out the ghostly white feline hunching in a corner, I put down the light, raised the weapon, and squeezed the trigger, aiming blindly. The report was deafening, but the recoil was worse. My precarious balance on the top step was lost, and I fell backward, crashing through the flimsy railing and dropping 10 feet to the concrete floor. When I tried to lift myself, the pain in my right leg was agonizing. I had fractured or broken a bone, and I was unable to move. There was a heavy mist of plaster in the room, and when it cleared, I saw just how bad my aim had been. The cat was still alive, and it was regarding me at this new level, its body sprinkled with plaster dust, its eyes now filled with hatred. I can't describe the gruesome thoughts that raced through my mind, or what exaggerations of horror troubled my brain. I began to crawl forward towards the fallen rifle, gasping with pain. My fingers touched the barrel. I looked backwards at my adversary and saw it advancing toward me. "Una!" I screamed and strained to retrieve the bicycle. My fingers closed on the center of the weapon and I pulled it towards me, grasping too quickly in my panic. My fingers were on the trigger, the rifle went off again, and the bullet struck me in the chest. The faded blue eyes dimmed once more. The lips paled and closed, the hands twitching over the sheets became still. "Enough for now," the intern said. Lieutenant Gardner agreed. He stood up. "Was it worth anything?" "Something," Gardner said. "He confessed to killing his wife." "Think he can manage to sign a statement?" "Not likely," the intern said. An hour later, Moresby died. The following morning, Lieutenant Gardner drove out to the Moresby home. It was a brilliant, sunshiny day, perfect for the beach. He thought of Moresby. He spoke briefly to the uniformed patrolman who had been posted the previous night at the scene of the tragedy. The officer reported a quiet night. "Think I'll take a look in that cellar," the lieutenant said. Nothing had been touched. The flashlight was still on the top step. There was a gaping hole in the corner where the bullet had shattered the plaster. The floor showed white dust except for the grim area where Moresby had fallen. There was one window in the cellar, a narrow one at the top of the long wall, permitting a thin rectangle of sunlight to enter the room. The window was open and a faint breeze stirred dust motes. Lieutenant Gardner went upstairs, and the patrolman offered him a cup of coffee. "Pretty sad," the officer said. "2 deaths in less than a month. Happens that way sometimes." "It happens," the lieutenant agreed. "When you were here last night, did you see any sign of a cat in the basement?" "A cat?" "No, sir, nothing like that." A moment later, Lieutenant Gardner lowered his cup. "Did you hear something?" "No." "Sort of a scratching noise?" He went to the cellar door and opened it. "I hear it now," the cop said. "Should we take a look, sir?" The lieutenant went into the cellar, the officer behind him. "For the love of Mike," the patrolman chuckled. "Take a look at that." In the center of the basement, the great shaggy white cat sputtered at them, dropping the squirming object in its mouth. Its outspread claws pinned it again, replaced it between eager jaws, and the cat dined. When its hasty meal was over, the cat bounded from one packing case to another until it reached the open window. Then it was gone with one quick backward glance at its audience, a look composed of satiety and triumph. "There goes your cat," the officer said. "We almost interrupted its dinner."
"Never mind that," Lieutenant Gardner said. "Did you see its eyes? The rat's eyes?"
"Eyes?"
"Yes, its eyes," the lieutenant said.
"Maybe I'm nuts, but they were blue."
"Did you ever see a rat with pale blue eyes?"